SF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
We've been living under a corporate state autocracy, whether the Democrats or Republicans, but Trump has come along. He's taken it to a new level of American fascism. He's unleashed the worst, ugliest forces in our country that were sort of under the surface because they didn't have a champion who got press every day and who had tweets every other minute. So yes, the threat of American fascism is very real, very perilous time. As far as how people vote, I say to people, vote your conscience.
That's Ralph Nader, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ralph Nader on corporate autocracy, fascism, Trump, and the election. Corporate power is more concentrated now than ever before. The rich are significantly richer. And the poor? Well, they know their place. There's an odor of fascism in the air. FDR once warned, "The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself." That, FDR said, in its essence, is fascism. You can hardly turn on the radio or TV or go online these days and not hear or read the sentence, "This is the most important election in American history." In response to the current crises, note the plural, we can moan and groan or we can act. The task for concerned citizens is what it always has been. Organize at the grassroots, resist oppression, and put forth positive alternatives. Our guest today is Ralph Nader. The son of Lebanese immigrants, he grew up in Connecticut. He's a legendary figure who has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in U.S. history. At age 90, he's as active as ever. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, Joe Biden's been in the White House for 3 years. What's your assessment of the 46th president?
Foreign and military policy, terrible, with capital letters. He's bloated the military budget. He's expanded the reckless, illegal armed force use of the empire. He doesn't seem to obey any international law. He's blanket, unconditional support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza, now viewed as such by the International Court of Justice, in addition to all the eyewitnesses accounts of the horrific slaughter of civilians, women, children, elderly, doesn't matter. All civilian targets have been hit in one way or another, and 2.3 million people, most of them are huddled down in the south without any housing, having fled at Israeli orders from the north to safe areas in the south, and then attacked again in acts of unspeakable treachery and sadism. And Joe Biden is supporting all this. He keeps saying, well, you should, Netanyahu, minimize civilian casualties and let more humanitarian trucks in. But he's shipping munitions on ships and airplanes day after day to contradict his rhetoric, his sweet talking. And so he has turned our country under international law into a co-belligerent with Israel, which is violating all kinds of international laws, including, I might add, something that Biden knows full well, that when a country moves into another area outside its borders and starts destroying people and things, they are required to protect the civilian population. And, of course, the Israeli military is doing just the opposite. It's destroying the civilian occupants and leaving them at the victims of disease, no water, no food, no medicine, no electricity, no fuel, no shelter, no ambulances, no hospitals, no health clinics. And Joe Biden is knee-deep, and to make matters worse, he wants to pass a genocide tax and make the American people pay another $14-plus billion to Netanyahu for his incredible defense blunder and collapse on October 7th, which is viewed as enough to get him out of office by 85% of the Israeli people in recent polls.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said October 7th did not happen in a vacuum. The media here in the United States in particular has been less than stellar, if I could say that, in terms of providing no context, no history, and no background as to the origins of the conflict and what might have spurred Hamas to attack on October 7th.
That's true. If you read 1,000 articles in the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, they always have the obligatory paragraph that this war started on October 7th when the Hamas went over the border with other groups and took 1,000 or so Israeli lives, most of them civilians, but still over 200 soldiers. And that's their starting point, instead of 1948, when David Ben-Gurion, in a later interview with the head of the World Zionist Organization, David Goldman, said it was their land and we took it. And they weren't going to indulge the rights of the indigenous Palestinians coming out of the Nazi Holocaust. And David Ben-Gurion is the founder of modern Israel, the first prime minister. That's when you could start. And then there's all the massive attacks over the years on the Palestinians, occupied, water stolen, land stolen, smashed houses, seizing hostages, putting them in jail as hostages for controlling Palestinian extended families, embargoes, you name it, checkpoints everywhere, suppression, separating children from families, barricading different areas in the West Bank. That's where you want to start. But you'll notice, even today, pick up the paper, any article on Gaza starts with October 7th. So this is the kind of discussion should go on in Congress. Congress, like a toady, it's a ditto head, of, along with Biden, of Netanyahu. I'm sure if Biden privately talks to Netanyahu and says things that are tougher, Netanyahu just says to him, well, Joe, why don't you take this up with our Congress? He controls the Congress, like 95% of the votes.
Do you mean literally he controls the Congress?
Yeah, of course. He has AIPAC. He has all kinds of other allies. The defense industry is on his side because there's a lot of business there. A lot of that $14.3 billion will come back in terms of contracts for more tanks, more F-16s, more deadly missiles, maybe phosphorus, maybe cluster bombs. Who knows? It's all secret. And Congress is not asked to approve it. Biden does it unilaterally after he gets the $14.3 billion. And it's okay with the vast majority of the Republicans and Democrats, with a few exceptions. So it's quite clear that no matter how many demonstrations, marches, public opinion demanding ceasefire, demanding cessation of military aid to Israel, using it for offensive purposes and violation of human rights, no matter that all over the country we have Jewish Americans, we have Arab Americans, we have African Americans, we have regular Anglo-Saxon Americans, it's a tremendous coalition that dominates dissent in the streets. But the power structure dominates the policy in the congressional suites and in the White House. And you know who wins in that contest, because we're not really a democracy, in fact.
How would you respond to the often quoted Israeli remark that all states have a right to defend themselves, and that's what we're doing as a result of October 7th?
Well, I have two responses. One is, do Palestinians have a right to defend themselves? I've never heard that uttered on Capitol Hill on the floor. I've heard Israel has a right to defend itself thousands of times. So all states have a right to defend themselves. The question with Israel, when it says it has a right to defend itself, is what's itself? What's its boundaries? It doesn't recognize normal boundaries because it wants to dominate all of Palestine, including the West Bank and Gaza. And in fact, by international lawyers, it's viewed as occupying both of those because the embargo is essentially an occupation of Gaza. And of course, they got soldiers all over the place in the West Bank. So what does defend itself mean? And who started it? The West, after World War II, facilitated the partition of Palestine and proceeded to topple all kinds of regimes in favor of dictatorships. The Shah of Iran was reinstalled after the democratically elected prime minister was removed by CIA operatives. That's a matter of record. I think it was 1953. And then there was a dictatorship by the Shah for 29 years. And we got along very well with dictators oppressing their people in the Arab countries. And we're all over their backyard. And why are we surprised when there's a little resistance? I guess you can't resist U.S. empire and the Israeli regional empire. That's verbatim. You can't resist. Of course, we resisted King George III for an occupation that was tepid compared to what the Palestinians have been going through. So that's one of the markers of empire. It demands no resistance, complete obedience, complete suppression. And if there is resistance, the response is massively disproportionate in terms of deaths, injuries, and destruction of civilian property. Look what we did after 9/11. We toppled the regimes in Iraq and Libya. We blew apart a lot of Afghanistan. Talk about disproportionate use of force. The Israelis are masters of this, especially in the current genocide in Gaza. And that's another war crime, another violation of international law. All this is going to come out after the end of this latest battle. The Israeli press will do its investigations. The refuseniks will perform their dramatic acts of courage and conscience, and Netanyahu will be voted out. Even his own party doesn't want him anymore. It's all going to come out, the videos, the various hearings that will come out, but it'll be too late for hundreds of thousands of Palestinian innocent civilians.
The Guardian reports that a review of internal State Department documents shows special mechanisms have been used by the Biden administration to shield Israel from U.S. human rights laws. What are those mechanisms?
Well, one of them is not to have any hearings at the State Department and not to put out any reports, because they put out annual reports on a lot of countries under their human rights framework of definition, and they protect Israel in that area. Secondly, there are no congressional hearings on it. The Israeli peace advocates and the Palestinian peace advocates have never been invited to a Senate or House hearing since 1948. And a lot of these Israeli peace advocates are former generals, mayors of cities like Haifa, former ministers of justice, and former heads of the equivalent of the Israeli FBI and CIA. They were outspoken in Israel. There's a documentary on the latter two former heads of the Israeli CIA and FBI, and they've never been invited. And, of course, any of the dissenters in Congress, there's always about 15 of them, they've never been able to get any hearings, never been able to get General Accounting Office investigations of how Israeli aid escapes the charge of human rights violation or use for offensive purposes. Big cover-up.
Israeli CIA is Mossad, and its FBI is called Shin Bet. Now, there's a handful of women, mostly, in Congress, in the House, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and, as I said, a handful of others who have stood up to the Biden administration and have been targeted by death threats and vilified and been the subject of, you know, vitriol and very, very nasty comments. How about those women who have stood up?
Well, they've been very courageous and they've been consistent. Their numbers have not multiplied very much. There are now about 70 members of the House who are calling for a ceasefire. That started with AOC and Rashida Tlaib and other women who you mentioned. So they are increasing their numbers, at least for a ceasefire. But Biden's against the ceasefire. He wants minimizing civilian casualties and more humanitarian aid, but he's against the ceasefire, right? You can't have both. Those trucks are going to come in with rockets and missiles all over the place, rutted roads. They're not going to reach their destination, even the few that are being allowed in. We're seeing here mass deliberate starvation. Someone called it a slow motion massacre. This is the Palestinian Holocaust. There's no other word for it. It's the irony of tragic history that the successors of the Jews in Western Europe, who were the victims of the Nazi Holocaust, their successors and the successors of their successors are now committing a Palestinian Holocaust. Over 500,000 Gazans out of the 2.3 are in the stages of starvation and dehydration now. And there's no light at the end of the tunnel. The chair of the Global Health Department at the University of Glasgow gave an interview in The Guardian about a month and a half ago, and she said, if this continues, over 500,000 Gazans will die in 2024 out of 2.3 million, and the rest will be damaged for life. They will have physical damage, horrendous mental illness, little children. Imagine 60,000 missiles, bombs, not counting artillery on the ground, not counting snipers, and the rest will also be sick in a whole variety of ways. You can't go on a piece of bread and a piece of cheese every 2 days and not damage your health for the long term, or contaminated water leading to dysentery and the damage to children of that. That's life-threatening. And if they survive, they're going to be sick for a long time. And, of course, Netanyahu wants to drive them completely out of Gaza into Jordan and Egypt. And that is how it's going to play out at the present time. With the co-belligerent Joe Biden, in our name, in our tax dollars, doing the bidding of someone who is the prime minister of Israel and is under 20% favorable in the polls. Over 80% of the people can't stand him. They want him out. But they're locked in under Israeli parliamentary law as long as the extreme small parties that make up his coalition don't break loose and the government falls and there has to be new elections. But as of now, that's not likely to happen.
Comment on propaganda and the uses of language in this conflict as well as others. I'm thinking particularly of a phrase that I'm sure you've heard multiple times, Iran-backed, Iran-linked, Iran-supported, Iran-proxy, Iran-controlled. Seems that Iran is being singled out for every single malfeasance in the entire Middle East.
That's because the U.S. militarists have singled out Iran as part of the axis of evil under Bush, along with Iraq and North Korea. And so Iran has been infiltrated, attacked by the Israelis, attacking scientists, surgical strikes inside Iran. And they look to their west and they see what happened to Iraq. They see the military on their west, the U.S., they see on the east, until U.S. got out of Afghanistan, the U.S. military, they see themselves targeted in all kinds of ways. And we wonder why they want proxies they want some distance from their border and supporting groups in Iraq and in Syria and Lebanon. I mean, who are we kidding? What if the shoe was on the other foot and we had some huge power doing that to us? You think we'd be watching the ball games and talking about Taylor Swift? Are you kidding? This is why Marine General Smedley Butler, who is a double recipient of Congressional Honor, wrote his book, War is a Racket. It's a total racket. And it isn't just the pro-Israeli government can do no wrong lobby in the U.S. It's also Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and all the weapons manufacturers who are making huge profits from the militarization of the U.S. empire abroad and its weapons systems to countries like Israel.
Well, you never hear the term, for example, you know, U.S.-backed Egypt or U.S.-linked and U.S.-supported Morocco. Those terms don't come into play at all.
Not at all. In fact, most people don't know we have 36 military installations in the Middle East. 36. They're in Syria, Iraq. They're in Jordan. They've got huge U.S. arsenals inside Israel that are being used now to destroy children, women, elderly, sick, innocent, adults, civilians, have nothing to do with Hamas. That's what's going on. As far as foreign and military policy, if we were a dictatorship, the people in this country would not have any less influence on the military-industrial complex, Congress, the Pentagon, the security agencies, and the White House. The people in this country, no matter how they protest, and there were huge protests, you remember, before the Iraq invasion, all over the world, but all over the United States, didn't have any impact on Bush and Cheney, the war criminals who are living the life of Riley now, after 1 million Iraqis or more were killed, and the country blown apart in what experts call a mass sociocide to this day.
What about those who equate criticism of Israeli state policies being labeled as anti-Semites?
The most powerful anti-Semites today are against the Arabs of Palestine. There is another anti-Semitism that Jim Zogby of the Arab American Institute in Washington, he gave a lecture to an Israeli university some years ago called The Other Anti-Semitism. It's against Arabs with armed force, not just rhetoric, number one. There's a lot of anti-Semitism against Arab Americans. There was also a civil debate, which you can listen to on debatingtaboos.org, between two prominent Jewish Americans and two prominent Arab Americans on the question, is there more anti-Semitism against Arab Americans in the U.S. than there is against Jewish Americans? And it was a very civil debate, and people flocked to that website, debatingtaboos.org, to get an example of a civil debate. Now, when you criticize a government armed to the teeth that is exploiting and occupying and devastating Palestinian territory, what's left of the original Palestine is about 22%. The rest is Israel. You are criticizing that state. You're not criticizing that religion. The American Council of Judaism for almost 80 years has been trying to draw the distinction between Judaism and the state of Israel. And they've gotten very little attention. Now, there is anti-Semitism against Jews everywhere, as there always has been, but the Jews in the United States have never been more secure by their own admission, and the leadership now in our country against the genocide in Gaza is led by Jewish American groups. If not now, Jewish Voice for Peace, they've raised the strategy of civic protests, nonviolent, to new levels of expertise. I really have to admire how they've raised the quality of these demonstrations and the strategic location, Grand Central Station, Statue of Liberty, members of Congress, offices, and so on. So you accuse them of being anti-Semitic, It's become a defamatory phrase, and it dilutes the horrific anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany. To dilute it and say that anyone who criticizes the slaughter in Gaza is anti-Semitic against Jews is to dilute it and to weaken the meaning of serious anti-Semitism coming out of World War II. Now, on December 13th, the New York Times, there was an open letter printed by 17 Israeli human rights groups led by Beth Salem, including the Refusnik Soldiers, including Rabbis for Human Rights. And it was an open letter titled, Stop the Human Catastrophe in Gaza. Open letter to Joe Biden. And it got almost no coverage. Are these groups anti-Semitic? They went after Netanyahu from A to Z in that letter.
You're listening to Ralph Nader on corporate autocracy, fascism, Trump, and the election. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. The focus on the Gaza and Ukraine wars has put the climate emergency on the back burner. 2023 was just the hottest year in recorded history. Glaciers continue to melt. Ocean temperatures are rising, as are sea levels. The last COP conference, that's conference on the parties, environmental groups, countries, was in Dubai, an oil producer. And the next one is to be in Azerbaijan, another autocratic oil producer. It's like putting arsonists in charge of the fire department.
Well, you've described the scene. The scene can only be called omnicidal. There are at least five major omnicides in our midst. The nuclear, chemical, biological warfare capabilities that can destroy the world as we know it, the viral and bacterial pandemics, which we're not prepared for, and we're messing with the environment to make this more likely and more mutationally rapid ahead of our medical responses, small as they are. We have the climate violence omnicide that is apparent in record floods, droughts, tornadoes, hurricanes, wildfires, sea level rises, and as you say, temperatures, that's another omnicide. And then we have the poverty, desperation omnicide that is going to lead to mass migrations and all kinds of instabilities. And then we have the elected dictatorships, which have paralyzed responding to the aforementioned omnicides. Why don't we pay attention? Because we spend, as a world, trillions of dollars on weapons, and we're armed to the teeth, and that's what's profitable to the corporate supremacists who control our country and other countries, including governments. And we're not paying attention to the necessities of the people. So it's the usual but very prescient reference to President Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial conflict, and he warned about it not just economically, he warned about it in terms of its displacing domestic necessities and that it's going to deprive us of our liberty. He used that word in his famous farewell address. So the challenge for the American people is not just to diagnose the problem, but to say, what institution can turn this around? Answer, the Congress. It has the constitutional authority on budgets, taxes, war declaration, waging peace, nominating officials, investigating the executive branch, and influencing state and local government. And there are only 535 people